my aunt, brother, sister, friend, they couldn't understand Bitcoin the way I was explaining it to them. I sent them your essay exploring mycology through a Bitcoin lens, and now they get Bitcoin.
Like, they just think, like, number go up, I buy the ETFs, and it's like, you don't even have an IOU for a Bitcoin. You have exposure to the price action. That Bitcoin is, hopefully, we haven't seen proof of reserves for much of it. Hopefully it's sitting somewhere, but that somewhere is very easily co-opted by government.
If they attempt to seize the Bitcoin, they could just seize the Bitcoin and pay themselves off, or they could seize the Bitcoin and have control of the supply and attempt to fork in changes that suit the government at the expense of the people.
It's like, we have tariffs. No, we're going to suspend them for a while. They're definitely coming back, but also maybe not. We've got some deals on the table, you know, like.
So usually these turnings take around 20 to 25 years. And so 20 years would take us to 2028. I think somewhere between 2028 and 2033 is where we'll see the resolution period.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Brandon Quidham. We had a fascinating conversation, in particular about the fourth turning. He talks about his thesis for how this is going to play out the next 5, 7, 8 years. And it's really, really interesting. So much of what you would imagine happening during a fourth turning is playing out right before us with all the chaos in the world. I really think you're going to enjoy this episode. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Brandon here. Brandon, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Man, I'm looking forward to this conversation. You've spoken about the fourth turning. I want to start there because I had an interesting conversation last week. I guess it was a week ago at the Bitcoin conference. I'm not going to tell you what that was about yet because I want you to sort of set the stage for the fourth turning. What is it? Kind of give people an understanding of when you talk about this and when you've described it, how you frame it, where you think we're at, and then we'll sort of take it from there.
Yeah, sounds good. So let's start with a little exercise. As a listener here, you're probably looking around the world and wondering what the heck is going on. Things are accelerating. I can't keep up with the pace. Why is everything so political? It feels like there's two social groups diverging even further in the US. What's going on? Too much debt. Government's crazy. What's going on? So back in 2020, I felt the same during the mid-year point that year. COVID lockdowns are starting. I see the world acting absolutely crazy. In the back of my head, I'm thinking, hey, maybe America is not just going to bend over here and do whatever the government says if it's not in their best interest. And instead, what we got was neighbors calling the cops on other neighbors and getting shamed for not wearing a cloth mask outside going for a walk. Like, the world was just going nuts. And so if you're feeling any of that, I felt the same thing. And that's what led me to the fourth turning. So I'm manic, maybe not like clinically manic, but I'm feeling relatively manic, cooped up in my house in Minneapolis, like 2-3 miles from where George Floyd died. And I start reading all these books and doing crazy research in my attempt to make sense of the world. Whether or not that's even possible, I'll leave that aside. But I found the fourth turning book. And in that book, they gave me a thesis that I thought most accurately mapped to what we were experiencing at the time. And we can go into what that is. So essentially found a thesis, mapped it to the world. All of a sudden, why was the world acting so crazy? Why were we collectivizing in a way that I didn't see coming? That's all explained by the thesis. And so it gave me some comfort knowing that we've been here before. It's not so crazy to go through this. And it seems rational in some weird sense. And so that's sort of the frame. That's how it entered my life. Wrote a big essay about it. Got quite popular in Bitcoin land. And now it seems like anyone related to Bitcoin got a cultural software update, and we now understand the fourth turning lens, and we can kind of see the world that way. And so it's found its way into Bitcoin culture, which is quite interesting. I'm happy to play a small role in that. So, okay, what is this thing? The authors were historians and demographers, Bill Strauss and Neil Howe. They wrote a series of books exploring those two topics, and they wrote a book called Generations, I want to say in the late 80s. Maybe early 90s. And through that process, they looked, let's say, 500 years back in the US, just looking at the different demographics. And they identified these generational cohorts of, let's say, around 22 years each. And what they found was that every four generations, a new cycle would start. Okay, and the end of that cycle, they later called the fourth turning. But I bring it up to say they weren't looking for patterns. They just discovered this weird pattern on accident by studying long-term history. And what they found is roughly every 80 to 90 years, society would go through a massive crisis period and essentially re-architect global power structures, our institutions, think government, politics, military, where the lines in the sand between countries, what international governing bodies do we work with to maintain stability in our society? All those things get reset in that fourth turning period. I'll skip to the punchline. We're in it right now, which is why things are going crazy. And unfortunately, I think they're going to accelerate from here and call it by 2030, maybe even as late as 2033. I think we'll be on the other side of this thing. And so that's the super high view. Now, what goes into this long-term cycle? The authors call it a saeculum, which means essentially a long human life. And so essentially, no one around during the last fourth turning period, which was 1929 to 1945. So Great Depression, stock market collapse, Great Depression, ultimately World War II. And on the end of World War II, we created the Bretton Woods financial system, the World Bank, IMF, NATO. And a little bit earlier, we did all these crazy things like deficit spending. We created Social Security, FDIC, right? All these social safety nets to essentially respond to the previous crisis period. So, hey, you lost all your money in the bank. Well, guess what? Now we have FDIC insurance. So the banks are covered by this new insurance scheme. Oh, you lost your job. Well, don't worry. We have unemployment insurance. We have Social Security when you retire, right? So we essentially respond to this crazy period and we re-architect the world in that response. And then 80, 90 years later, those institutions that were created again in the 30s and 40s have now essentially, they're no longer useful in today's context. And the world starts to fall apart and we don't have these strong institutions to keep order around. And we all of a sudden collectively look around and we say, hey, wait a minute, society's going off the rails. We better do something about this. And our intuition or whatever as a species in that moment is something like, hey, times are hard and we need to make massive sacrifice. We need to band together in order to overcome this existential threat. And whether it's actually existential in the form of a World War II scenario or the previous fourth turning was the Civil War and then the Revolutionary War, right? So we have all these different total war periods that map to fourth turnings. And because of that total war scenario, where it's very easy to collectivize and make large changes. That's roughly the arc. Now, how do we get this arc? Why can we predict this? Is this just a horoscope for intellectuals? Is this doom porn? What is this? And the authors, again, came up with those four different generational archetypes. And they repeat. Prophet, nomad, hero, artist. Prophet, nomad, hero, artist. Right. And depending on where you are in that 80 to 90 year cycle, the author broke it into four stages. The end stage is the crisis. That's the fourth turning. That's what we've been discussing. The midway point is when we redo our interior world. So all the religious movements over the last 500 years happened at the midway point of this cycle. And in the beginning of the cycle, it's the first turning. That's right after the crisis. We're kind of tired. We're sick of fighting. We just want to chill out. That's when equality is highest. That's when culture is the most muted. We're kind of sick of the chaos. We just want to chill out. The last one was white picket fence, 50s, Leave It to Beaver, right? That era. And then the kids who are born during that really, really sterile culture time, they grow up and predictably they push back on their parents. And that's the boomer generation. So they grew up in a really boring time of like Woody Guthrie and folk music. And then what do? They create the psychedelic 60s, the civil rights movement, right? Dramatic pushback from their parents' age. Then the boomers grow up, they have kids, and they underparent those kids. You know, the hippies grow up and they don't really want to have families, but they do it anyways. So then you have this Gen X generation that's underparented, and we start to deregulate and we start to just take off social safety nets, crime skyrockets. What happens then? Then the millennials are born and the pendulum swings back again. And then we overparent the millennials. I assume you're a millennial. I am too. This is seventh place ribbons, DARE program, baby on board stickers. You can see it in the media, right? We go from Terminator and the Goonies to like laugh track sitcoms and family, kind of family drama TV shows. And the little kids are always the heroes instead of like the lost kids, right? And so it really immerses itself in culture. And then we get right up to 08. And again, what is 08? That's the parallel to 1929, global financial crisis, stock market collapse. And that's the beginning of our current fourth turning. And during this period, that's what explains cancel culture, right? We have this instinct to collectivize. And so we also have an instinct to kick out the people who aren't on the mission with us. So you're either with us or you're against us. And that sort of breeds the grounds for the division. And politicians, they capture this moment. I don't think they do it consciously. They just do it for their own interest, which is in the 90s, if there's bad things going on around the world, the politicians will minimize the negatives. They'll say, hey, it's not so bad. Don't worry. We're all good. And then from 08 on, the politics changed, right? It's hope and change. It's make America great again, right? The politicians emphasize the negative, and they demonstrate, or they attempt to demonstrate, how I as a candidate or I as a party can come in and save you guys from the bad stuff, right? So it's complete opposite. And again, the last point here, which is how do you know which cycle we are? Well, it depends which stage of life those archetypes are in. Are the idealistic boomers in charge? Okay, fine. Then we're going to have a certain type of politics. Are the heroes at this stage or that stage? Where are the artists, right? If you're a young person and you're born during a certain period, well, the context around your birth and your upbringing is relatively similar to all your peers. So again, we're millennials. We're born in this period of overparenting. So we all kind of grow up in the same context. And the millennial generation gets forged by the context in which we were raised. And then we become older and we start to push back on the world in this predictable way. And so it's really the constellation of those archetypes that define the mood. And the mood is what we can use to predict how we respond to catalysts. We can't predict a catalyst, but we can loosely predict how society will respond, again, based on that constellation of archetypes. And yeah, okay. That's a lot to chew on. Let's start with that. Where do you want to go?
No. Well, I think that was about as succinctly put as I think you could, a great explanation. So how long does the turning typically take? And so here, I'll fill you in on the conversation I had. And unfortunately we didn't get to dive down this rabbit hole far. I had like a 4-hour dinner and we were talking about like, you know, how Bitcoin should be used and everything. So we didn't really talk fourth turning much. But the individual who I was speaking with said something to the effect of he felt like the fourth turning was COVID, and now we're kind of out of it. You've indicated that this maybe ends late 20s. And to me, because he's like, you know, if I told you they're going to shut down the world, you know, this and that, like everyone's going to be crazy and everything he described that happened during COVID, you know, wouldn't you say that sounds like kind of the, you know, the climax of the fourth turning? And to me, I look at the world and I'm like, if this is not still the fourth turning, then I'm not looking forward to the first. You know, like, so what's that typical time frame in which a fourth turning kind of, you know, makes its turn? And why do you view late 20s, you know, 20, 30 because of the typical time frame in which that usually happens, or because you just anticipate more of this madness kind of coming down for the next 5 years?
Yeah, great question. So during COVID, when I originally wrote this essay in 2020, I did suspect at that time that COVID was a perfect catalyst to ultimately become the climax, right? Every fourth turning has a climax. Every fourth turning has been total war, and every total war has been in a fourth turning. So those two are correlated. The two reasons why, one, it's too fast. So usually these turnings take around 20 to 25 years. And so 20 years would take us to 2028. I think somewhere between 2028 and 2033 is where we'll see the resolution period. So that's point one. that wouldn't be enough information, because I think we can pull forward or pull back these cycles a little bit based on technology, based on the actual details on the ground. But the real reason is because we're still fighting. We haven't band together. There's no exhaustion period yet. So I think we're still ramping. And if you see division like this, which is still growing, we're not done. What we need to see is, let's say Americans band together and agree about something and make a big change. I would say COVID was just tiptoeing forward. And what did it do? It divided us further. And yeah, so right. There was a world where we all band together and, quote, fight the virus and we're all on the same side. But instead, the virus wasn't as big of a deal as it was made out to believe. There was a lot of tyrannical activity from our government in the process. So it just made it worse.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that was kind of my sense, because candidly, for all of the tyranny of COVID, it was for me, like, my wife and young daughter and I hunkered down and, like, we had a pretty good time. And, like, we live close to family. We're fortunate, like, we could get out and, like, see them, even though we weren't allowed to do a whole lot of other things. But to me, it didn't, as crazy as it was, it didn't feel quite like the world was falling apart. And now I'm getting signals of more widespread calamity to come, potentially, you know, like, I don't know what the impetus would be for a world war exactly, because I don't think there seems to be an appetite for China or Russia, which are kind of the boogeymen in my view of the United States. But I agree with you. Like, we seem very far from any level of, like, consensus around here's our path forward together collectively. I mean, that feels like a pipe dream at the moment. So, okay. So do you have a thesis then on what you, do you think war is going to be going to define the next 5 to 8 years, or do you think that's just one potential outcome, but you've got maybe something you think is more likely?
Yeah. So back to the previous point, all fourth turnings have had a large war. And so, mm-hmm. And all large wars have been in a fourth turning. So I think the money is on, we are going to have a large conflict, larger than we've had in the last 80 or 90 years coming up here. But I want to be cautious and say, I don't think the thesis requires war. It just requires a catalyst large enough to get us to make massive sweeping changes around the world. But again, I would bet on war. So what do I think it looks like? I think one risk is that America fractures even further and we accelerate something like a civil war 2.0. Now, do I think that's extremely likely? Probably not, but I think that we're heading down that path. It wouldn't take too much to turn the context in America now into something like a civil war, right? You have LA ICE going after immigrants right now around the country. LA feels like it's erupting, right? So there could be a world where we overstep policy on immigration, let's say. People fight back. It turns into a bunch of skirmishes around the US that sort of become like hit and run, many factions, kind of disorganized social unrest type thing that gets out of control. I could see that. And if America does go down that path, I would expect our adversaries abroad to say, hey, this is a good opportunity. America's focused inward. They have a debt problem. They have social problems. Trump's sort of pulling back our influence in the East in an attempt to be a more multipolar world, or kind of just focus on America. And I think that opens up a vacuum for opportunistic warfare abroad. So I think that's one path, civil war that leads to something abroad. I also think power competition with China is a real risk. I think that the Middle East is a hotbed. Russia, Ukraine's a hotbed. So I think we have a lot of catalysts abroad that could lead to a power competition with China. But I don't expect a like total war over the continents type thing. I expect something more modern, something more technologically savvy, something with more deniability, plausible deniability. So maybe trade war, maybe blocking trade routes with drone swarms, maybe hacking our infrastructure to shut down a power grid, right? This sort of like subversive warfare is what I expect at this stage, rather than like let's line up our militaries and blow stuff up. And I think You could even say that we're already in a cold war with China, right? They've hacked all our stuff. We're trying to hack all their stuff. Trade wars are ramping up. But the reality is America and China are in bed together economically right now. And so it's in both parties' interest not to have like a sharp cutting of the ties and instead like a re-architecting of trade, re-architecting of financial system globally. And I expect some conflict out of that.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I've been seeing, like, I don't know if you were, you told me before offline that you don't really keep up with the news the way some people do, and it's less interesting to you. But you may have caught, like, I think Spain, Portugal, parts of southern France had blackouts. I think Spain had people were losing like cell service, which is relatively uncommon. Now they're locking people out of their bank accounts if they are trying to withdraw more than 3,000 euros. Or, you know, like it almost felt like for like 2 weeks or something, like Spain was this microcosm of what could be, or maybe this sort of scenario that you're talking about, where it's like it's not a kinetic war where the lines are drawn between the US and China or the US and Russia or BRICS or whatever, but rather these sorts of, you know, it's you know, hacks, it's technology, it's yeah, just maybe like these new ways of fighting that we haven't historically seen. And I think the trade war, it seems to be, I don't know how that's going to pan out. It's like we have tariffs. No, we're going to suspend them for a while. They're definitely coming back, but also maybe not. We've got some deals on the table. You know, like I think that's part of people's frustration trying to sift through this is like the unpredictability, because we still have fallible humans making judgment calls, or, you know, misjudgments, I suppose you could say, along the way.
Yeah. One comment on that quick before we move on. So during fourth turnings, historically what has happened is we're in a crisis period and the government says, hey, what levers do we have? And what they always have done historically has gone to a softer form of money. And so it could be like private money, like the greenbacks. It could be in World War II, we started deficit spending for the first time. You could say during COVID, we turned on the money printer, right? So that's a tool for the government to essentially borrow from the future and try to solve today's problems. And so we're in massive debt, historic levels of debt around the world. It's been building for a very long time. And there's nowhere for the debt to go. And so we do need to figure out what we're going to do with sovereign debt around the world. But before we get to the point of resolution, high debt and poor economic conditions for individuals just makes us fragile as a society. And I would say related to that is we're on the margin on energy production. And with the upcoming demand for AI, which is going to be a whole nother arms race, everywhere in the world needs to be producing more energy than they are today in order to keep up with that demand. And you can't just print energy. Right. So you can print all the money you want, which just makes energy prices go up, but you can't just print a power plant and print some new high voltage transmission lines to move that power around. And so I think we're going to get squeezed on power. We've seen it already in Germany in a historic way where after Nord Stream pipeline and also combined with some, I will say, batshit crazy social policies in Germany where they shut down nuclear plants, et cetera. And what happens? Industrial companies that are 300-400 years old, so they've survived everything in the last, let's say, 300 years. They couldn't survive the supply crunch on energy in the last 5 years, right? Just to put a line in that sand. So it's bad in certain places. And you see China producing tons of energy. I think the Trump administration is trying to open doors to create more energy. But it takes a long time to do that. And so all that's to say the debt, the energy conditions, the social climate, all that stuff contributes to making us feeling more vulnerable, which makes a small catalyst more likely to accelerate things, right? If everyone's in a strong financial position, we're feeling resilient and optimistic about the future, little catalysts don't really get us going. But if we're very much backed against a wall, a small thing turns into a big thing very quickly.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Well, that's interesting because you hear people talking about like onshoring, you know, whether it's drilling or like, hey, let's look back at nuclear energy, and the sort of the common narrative around those subjects is, well, it's going to take us, you know, 5 or 10 years to be able to build that infrastructure back. And it's like, well, okay, well, that that adds up, perhaps. Like, it gets you to the end of the fourth turning where you're struggling through that. And then on the other side of it, now we have this new infrastructure that we can leverage, and it makes sense. So what does, so I think you've segued me nicely into, okay, well, what's the role of Bitcoin in all of this, and into, you know, as we, I guess, sort of complete and migrate out of the fourth turning. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that. Let's start with that. What's Bitcoin doing here?
Yeah. So like all good Bitcoiners, I see everything through orange tinted glasses. So I could have some biases here where I want to overstate Bitcoin's role. However, I don't think I'm doing that. So what happens in a fourth turning? We go through a crisis period and we need two things. We need to figure out the debt problem, because that's just a systemic risk that's pushing us down and down and down. We got to get out from under it. There you go. That's one. The other one is we need strong institutions to bring order back. So we're all seeking order. Okay, I think Bitcoin, properly understood, addresses both of these two issues. I think one way to view Bitcoin is as a new foundational institution for our culture. Money's half of every transaction. It sort of is like this invisible membrane that determines how well or poorly we do as a world. Better money leads to better outcomes, right? And Bitcoin's unique in a way that it's not owned by any individual. It's not owned by a government. It's not owned by a corporation. It's owned by all of the individual participants. And I think that is the type of institution that can provide trust in a way where, let's say, China and the US don't trust each other, change the reserve currency or re-architect global finance. China doesn't want to work in our system. We don't want to work in their system. And so having a neutral settlement layer that the entire world can use and not trust in your counterparty fits really nicely here. It also has the counterbalance of the supply being fixed. And so next to a monetary system with unlimited inflation, unlimited money printing, and with the amount of debt we have, we must print increasingly more money to not go bankrupt. And so you're going to see one go crazy juxtaposed to a Bitcoin system that sort of acts as the counterforce. It also increases the Bitcoin price when we print the money, right? And so you kind of have this escape hatch or a life raft, if you will. And so what this means in the short term is that individuals, corporations, nation states, any size group can adopt Bitcoin and essentially shelter themselves from some amount of the financial pain. And so over time, we're letting pressure out of the system by people going over to the Bitcoin system. And in that world, we have fewer people who are desperate. And so it actually lowers tension every single day people adopt Bitcoin, because they feel a little more secure about their future. And so in one sense, I think it has a chance to reduce the magnitude of this fourth turning, because we're saving people every day, quote unquote. And then I'm at the mature state. We need to redo the financial system. So I think Bitcoin has a chance to take center stage here as the new global settlement reserve asset. And TBD if we're going to get there. I predict gold will have one more attempt here, at least by some countries around the world. But I do think Bitcoin is the right next step for the world. We're moving digital, and we have this perfect digital money that suits us in the modern age. And the institutional grade, like, safety it brings to people, I think, is the other side. So I view Bitcoin as fourth turning money. It was born at the start at the global financial crisis. Obviously, the intellectual history is earlier, but the cypherpunks and others could, I think, forecast what happens in a digital age. And so they were laying the groundwork in the third turning. As soon as the fourth turning hits, Satoshi drops the white paper, and Bitcoin essentially has only known a fourth turning. And it's the most resilient software project we've ever created. And it's the most resilient money we've ever created. So it also had to be born in the fourth turning, because I don't think people would have adopted such a Spartan technology if it didn't have a little bit of chaos around us, right? If all financial system and economic stuff were humming and everyone's feeling pretty good there, there's no incentive to go find this Bitcoin thing. But because Bitcoin is born in chaos, it leads to adoption at an accelerated rate. And so I think it's fourth turning money. I think in the first turning, we will be on a Bitcoin standard globally. Doesn't mean we won't have dollars or other fiat currencies, but I think we'll move away from a U.S. Treasury system, which is essentially the reserve asset today. I think we're going to move away from that and instead store the fruits of our labor in Bitcoin rather than U.S. government debt.
Is there some sort of a debt jubilee that you anticipate, or is it governments adopt Bitcoin and then are able to pay down their debt? Or I'll just tell you, feel free to push back on this. Anyone who's listened to this podcast for any length of time knows my opinion of strategic reserves for governments is it's not something I'm excited about. I don't like governments having more power. Even if they could leverage Bitcoin to pay down the debt, first, I think it would have to be done through some sort of theft, because that's the way that governments accumulate, you know, money or anything. But I'm concerned that it would be something that, okay, you can pay down the debt because of, you know, the value and the purchasing power of Bitcoin increases. And then we're kind of back to square one. It's not really adopted as money. It's adopted as this thing to pay down the debt. And then the money printer turns on again because politicians want to spend and give freebies and this and that. And so I view the problem as a spending problem more than a debt problem. Obviously we have a debt problem, but the debt problem didn't just magically appear. It's because of years and years, decades of spending money that we just don't have, we shouldn't have created. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on like the strategic reserves, but also how you think maybe that fits into it.
Definitely. I think it could play out a few different ways, but let's go through these. So you see a lot of people saying, hey, why are we cheering on governments buying Bitcoin or banks or corporations? I thought we were against these things. And my honest opinion is I think that's an ideologically naive take. And the reason is, if Bitcoin is this impressive monetary asset with no second best, then we should assume that, properly understood, everyone's going to want to buy it. And so I view that if Bitcoin was going to be successful, we were inevitably going to enter the stage we're in now, the financialization stage. So this is a sign of winning. And there's no future where Bitcoin is a $100 trillion asset and it produces the tools we need for self-sovereignty, which I think most Bitcoiners agree with. I certainly do. But the only way we're going to achieve that at scale is if Bitcoin's a very large asset with technology and infrastructure to allow anyone to use it in any situation. So we needed a capitalization event in order to become large-scale sovereign money. That's my initial point. Will we have a debt jubilee? Is the government just going to ride the Bitcoin price up, pay off the debt, and go back to their old games? I think those are legitimate questions. I see one way, which is that we adopt Bitcoin and we essentially have a decade of financial repression, meaning if you own bonds or you own the dollar, you're going to be having negative real returns for the next decade. So let's say inflation rate is at 7%, bonds are paying out 5%, right? So you're losing 2% a year, anyone who holds those bonds. If you hold dollars, you're losing 7% purchasing power per year. So if we do that for a decade, we'll essentially devalue our current debt by a pretty significant amount, so that the nominal value of the debt won't go down, but the real value of the real cost of the debt will go down in the process, combined with incredible growth. So we need to line up a better trade, AI, whatever technology we can muster, cheaper energy costs, add all that up. So we're showing real growth, simultaneously stealing purchasing power from dollar holders and bond holders over a decade. If we do that, there's a way where we get out of this without a total collapse or something that requires a jubilee. I think that's the best case scenario. I think that's what they're going to attempt to do. That's what they did in the 40s after World War II. However, the difference in the 40s was that our debt loads were way lower. And we had a huge influx of capital to support the war efforts and the rebuilding efforts. So essentially, America was in a good position because we invested in infrastructure in our borders. Fighting ends, the world's in disarray, and we just have all these new capital assets. We convert the war machine into the industry machine. And so I would say we have a much harder go at it. But as far as I can tell, they're going to attempt the same playbook, which did work after World War II. Now, I think the debt situation is way, way, way worse, and we're way closer to issues then. So I'm not as optimistic about it. honestly, I don't know what it could look like, but I do expect maximum pain and Bitcoin holders to be rewarded. And so hopefully we don't have like a total collapse and sovereign debt bubble, because that will take down everything. No one wants to go through that. Maybe Bitcoin rises from the ashes, but you're not going to be excited about a world where you're wealthy and your neighbors are starving. And so we want the slow transition as much as possible. And that means we should accelerate Bitcoin's adoption as fast as possible and build out the tools so that when people are ready, they can onboard to the Bitcoin system. And I will say, I think we've done a pretty good job there. We're not ready to 10x adoption tomorrow, but yeah, I think we're laying the groundwork for massive inflow. And I do think the Bitcoin treasury companies, sovereign adoption, ETFs, I think all of those are massive scalability improvements in a sense that allows people to onboard. No, they don't have the same value system. No, they don't protect against a 6102D attack, like how FDR confiscated all the gold. Those are still very real risks. And so while I view the financialization phase as inevitable, it does come with risks that we need to be aware of. And I think the primary one that I have my eyes on that maybe not everyone agrees with is that I think at maturity, best case scenario, we have 5% of people, of individuals in self-custody. And the reason is self-custody, it's not that hard, but the average person does not want that much responsibility and they would much rather trust a bank. Trusting a bank or trusting some institution to hold your money is really easy to do, and people want that. And so I expect it. But on the other side of that, what we need is at least, let's say, 51% of the supply held by those 5% of individuals in self-custody. So it's really about the supply concentration in my mind. And so what that means is we need the wealthy Bitcoiners to have self-custody. And overwhelmingly today, they do hold their Bitcoin private keys themselves. And I think that's not really from some strategic way. That's simply because Satoshi released the supply schedule so ruthlessly in the beginning, right? Half of the 21 million issued in the first 4 years, then a quarter of the total supply issued by year eight, 75% of the supply by year eight before most people even heard of Bitcoin, right? And so that early ideological people, they hold most of the supply overwhelmingly in self-custody. So we have a buffer now that gives me some confidence. But as we march forward, that supply will increasingly become in some sort of a third-party custody arrangement. And so that's, to me, the metric to watch.
I mean, you gave me a lot to think about in a lot of ways we could potentially take this. So I'm curious, could you maybe just double click on why you think the importance of having 51% of supply matters in this small handful of individuals who, you know, are in self-custody, probably running nodes? Like what's the significance of the supply specifically? Because I agree with you. I'm an open-minded guy. So if I'm ideologically naive, and I agree with you too, that all of everything that's happening was inevitable. And so it's not so much, governments, my issue with governments is more of, the value that they have has been extracted. What Michael Saylor is doing or what anyone else is doing, like I have my issues with, I'm not interested in buying that product, because I want to buy Bitcoin, and I'm not here to speculate on, fiat equities. But I think corporate adoption is a great thing. The more companies we can have buying, the more individuals we can have buying. I would love for it to see more of it outside of the hands of one or two major custodians. I think that is a real risk. And to your point,
agree.
People downplay it, or just, I think most people don't even understand it. They just think number go up, I buy the ETFs, and it's you don't even have an IOU for a Bitcoin. You have exposure to the price action. That Bitcoin is hopefully, we haven't seen proof of reserves for much of it. Hopefully it's sitting somewhere, but that somewhere is very easily co-opted by government.
That's right.
So anyway, I just said a lot. Tell me why you think 51% for this small group of self-custody holders is so important.
Yeah. And just to emphasize the point, it's more about the 51% supply. I don't care if it's in a small number of hands or a large number of hands. I prefer more hands holding the 51%. I just think realistically, most people won't want to do self-custody. They'll accept the trade-offs of custodying their Bitcoin with an institution. But the reason why I say that is exactly what you mentioned around not enough custodians holding the supply. So, okay, worst case scenario, sovereign debt bubble in the next 5 years, hot war with China, the world's blowing up all over the place, chaos is ensuing, right? And that world will have extreme inflation because the U.S. government will have to print all the money. They have to print new money to buy our debt to keep the game going. Mm-hmm. And then they say, hey, things are looking pretty bad. Bitcoin's worth $10 trillion now. Half of that roughly is held in the U.S. What if we just nationalize miners, nationalize Coinbase, nationalize MicroStrategy or Strategy? That's the risk I'm worried about, is if push comes to shove, governments around the world will attempt to seize the Bitcoin, or they may. And so if they attempt to seize the Bitcoin, they could just seize the Bitcoin and pay themselves off, or they could seize the Bitcoin and have control of the supply and attempt to fork in changes that suit the government at the expense of the people. That's what I'm trying to prevent. So if the honeypot is large, they increase the risk of going after it. And if the honeypot's too large, they'll go after it, and they could theoretically fork the supply and create new rules. And so that's the extreme risk I'm worried about.
Okay. So I'm speaking about this in Prague. I think about this a lot. And one of my big concerns is the manner in which Bitcoin wins. Like, I think because of all these catalysts, Bitcoin's absolute scarcity, all of these attributes it possesses, it's very, very likely that we win in that Bitcoiners are, especially those who hold their coins in self-custody, are rewarded financially. But that somehow we could come out of this with Bitcoin sort of sitting idly as a reserve asset, the way gold, hypothetically at least, is sitting at Fort Knox or whatever, and it hasn't saved us from any of the forever wars. We kind of have this digital gold Fort Knox sort of narrative around Bitcoin, and nothing is quite resolved the way that many of us who talk about fix the money, fix the world, the bright orange future, we're hoping. Is that something you worry about, could anticipate, or do you think I'm crazy and don't worry, it's going to be used as currency and people are going to exchange, buy fighter jets with Bitcoin, that sort of thing, and so it's going to limit the ability of government to do some of the, terrible things that government tends to do?
Yeah, it's the right question. I absolutely worry about it. I've been working on an essay off and on for years. Once I had our first child, I slowed down my writing a little bit, but I have an essay that I need to dust off and publish that goes over this exactly. I think the easiest way to explain this or frame up this question is Bitcoin a 50-year money? Or is Bitcoin a 500-year money? If we look over the last few hundred years, let's say every 30 to 80 years, we swap out our monetary system in some way, right? We went on Bretton Woods after World War II. That decayed by 71. We went off the gold standard and we entered the Treasury Reserve standard or petrodollar standard now. And so we've already seen three iterations in the last, let's say, 100 years. I think Bitcoin is past the point of failing in the next couple of years type thing. I think the economic case is sound. I think it will go up to 100 trillion. I think the next stage will be, does it become ghettoified, or does it become like gold 2.0 and it's just an asset? And then 50 years later, we just decide another chaos goes on. Bitcoin gets co-opted. It doesn't actually protect us from systemic risks like we hope it does. And something else comes along and outpaces Bitcoin. I think that's a real risk. I think Bitcoin's the first monetary attempt in history to become the 500-year money or the 5,000-year money. But we're not through the woods on that yet. I think all the risks you brought up are real. And just to tease the essay a little bit, are you familiar with the Apache Indians? They settled in the Southwest U.S.
Heard of them, yeah.
Okay, so as far as we know, they came over the Bering Strait from Asia sometime, let's say 10 to 15,000 years ago, through Canada, down through the Southwest Corridor, west of the Rockies, and ultimately settled in the Southwest U.S. and northern Mexico. Okay, so they have a unique social structure where the Apaches don't have like a rigid hierarchy. Instead, they just follow whatever leaders they want. And so hey, I want to go over here. Anyone want to come with me? Yeah, you're a good leader. Let's go that way. That type of thing. And so it's like a loose social protocol where they can come together in large groups, they can fracture, they can do whatever. And that creates a very decentralized governance structure, which makes it hard for centralized actors to take them over. So if we go through history, Cortez came and he took over Tenochtitlan, modern day Mexico City. Then he went further north and he did this with like 100 or 200 horsemen against a huge empire, because he went straight to the leader, co-opted the leader, civilization captured. Cortez and his horsemen go north. They find the Apache, kill the leader. They think they took over this land. And what happens? The Apache fractures in two or four or eight. And they're like, wow, we can't defeat the Apache. Anytime we try to build a fort here, they just capture it in the middle of the night. They steal all their horses, right? They have this like decentralized hit and run thing. Cortez tries for a decade or two, gives up, leaves. Later, Mexico gets their independence. They go north. They try to capture the territory. They run into the same problem. They can't stop the Apache. They're everywhere and nowhere all at once. They give up. Then the U.S. Western migration occurs. We try to take over their lands. The U.S. fails. So now we're at like 300 years of this. They have less technology. They have less people. They shouldn't be able to withstand the biggest armies in the area, and yet they do. Okay, so it kind of sounds like Bitcoin, right? The Apaches, they're everywhere and nowhere. You can't stop them. And they push decision-making to the edge. So it's really like a whole bunch of little leaders acting locally in their best interest. Fast forward to the punchline, what happens? Ultimately, the U.S. says, hey, we can't fight them head-on. It's too expensive. We can't hold the land. Let's try to co-opt them. So they go to the leaders and they give them 100 head of cattle and they say, hey, here's some wealth. Here's a peace offering. Distribute it amongst your people however you see fit. What happens? The leaders create a council and they try to attempt to distribute the wealth. Historically, they don't keep wealth. They're on horseback. They move around. It's your tools. It's your knowledge. That's your wealth. All of a sudden, they give them all this cattle. And what happens? The Apache essentially corrupt themselves from the inside, and they end up ultimately on the reservations. And so we don't want Bitcoin to be co-opted from the inside and be put on the reservations. I think making all the Bitcoiners extremely wealthy will definitely pacify a large percentage of us and to say, hey, well, I don't need to fight the good fight anymore. I'm going to move to the Rocky Mountains in my citadel and live out my days with my family. I'm going to give up the fight. And so I think we're entering that phase. I don't know where it's going to go. I do trust the Bitcoin thing. I trust the cypherpunks and the Bitcoin psychopaths to make this thing happen. But it is a real risk. And I wouldn't say I have like extreme confidence that we get there. But I will say we have a chance for the first time ever to unshackle money from governments. And we should do our best not to squander this opportunity. Because if we do take money away from state, I think it will lead to greater outcomes over the long term. And so we should give it everything we have.
Yeah. And maybe I think anything gets corrupted. And I don't know over what time horizon. I think maybe the best chance we have is it seems like Bitcoiners now, although I'm disappointed by some of like the simping for like not real Bitcoin. And I understand your point. It's taken that, you know, a lot of this is inevitable, but the more people that we can have who are like, they're sold on Bitcoin and they're buying MicroStrategy shares instead of buying Bitcoin. Not to say, you know, you got a retirement account or you just want to speculate with a little bit. Like, you know, I get it. Like make your own decision. It's a free market. But I wish we had more people talking about self-custody, running a node, doing those sorts of things to get us to that, you know, 5% or whatever that minimum percentage needs to be, ultimately, to have longer term hope. I think the second thing that gives me hope is it seems like Bitcoiners are having more kids. We're talking about more traditional family values. I can tell you, like, when I was at the Bitcoin conference, I picked up like all the Tuttle Twins stuff. I like started reading, you know, one of these books to my 6-year-old. So like, I'm hoping that like we sort of pass that vigilance down, but I think we need to have it and internalize it in ourselves to begin with. And I fear that there's a pretty large percentage of people who would describe themselves as a Bitcoiner who maybe haven't quite crossed that chasm. So, more education. I think the essays that you're writing, like the content that we're putting out, is hopefully helpful for people in getting there. You touched on, you were talking about the Apache, and I almost said, oh, almost like a fungus, because I wanted to give you an opportunity. You had this great series on Bitcoin mycelium of money. Why don't you just like briefly describe that thesis? I think it's just like a really interesting thing. I'm also curious, do that quickly, but then when you write those sorts of things, because they're so like philosophically interesting, do you write them to clarify your thinking? Do you write them for quote unquote normies who maybe are trying to understand Bitcoin, or do you write them for other Bitcoiners to maybe help them round out their understanding of this new technology?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wrote Mycelium of Money in four parts. The first part I wrote in 2018 and successively over the years since. In 2018, I was maybe 6 to 9 months down the rabbit hole. And so I was just clarifying my own thoughts. I have a long history with mycology as an amateur. I like foraging for mushrooms. I like the ecology side. I like cooking them. I like the psychoactive ones. I just find the whole kingdom fascinating. And so when I put together the parallels, I just had fun exploring ideas. I like ideas. I like weird topics. I like analogies. And so it started out scratching my own itch, and I didn't expect it to be super popular. At the time, there wasn't a lot of weird philosophical niche content. It was a lot of finance, a lot of technology stuff. And I'm like, hey, are you sure Bitcoin's not alive? And to my surprise, the Bitcoin community, now it's obvious, but the Bitcoin community accepts weird ideas, and we're all trying to make sense of this thing. And so I fit into the Bitcoin community more than I expected at the time. Now I think about these things as a way to explain a new phenomenon. There really aren't priors for Bitcoin. We call it digital gold. That's okay, right? We're all using analogies to try to explain this thing. And so that's my motivation at this point, is novel ways to explore it. Also, I like this stuff. So in a way, I'm writing for like the 25 Bitcoin philosopher, writer, thinkers that I respect, if I'm being totally honest. But my favorite feedback is, hey, my aunt, brother, sister, friend, they couldn't understand Bitcoin the way I was explaining it to them. I sent them your essay exploring mycology through a Bitcoin lens, and now they get Bitcoin. And so that's probably the most gratifying result from all this kind of stuff. Let's jump into the theory really quick. So What is mycelium of money? So fungi is a whole kingdom. There's plants, there's animals, there's fungi. There's more fungi than plants and animals combined. So it's a whole kingdom. It's very diverse, and they're very strange. And the primary form that a fungus takes is a mycelial form, which is essentially a one-cell wall underground root structure. So it's a series of tubes and pumps sending information, sending resources bidirectionally underground. They connect to all the tree roots. They digest all the organic matter, like a branch falls in the woods, fungus eats it, recycles all the materials. So they perform really important roles in our ecology. And if you cut a mycelial network in half, you have two mycelial networks. There's no central processing unit. There's no brain. It's more like a bunch of individuals working together with a common goal. And it's also a very hard to stop form. Fungus, they survived all the great extinction events. They make their own food. They don't need sunlight. They can adapt. They evolve very quickly. They're just the definition of anti-fragile is mycelium. And so similar to that, you have Bitcoin. It's distributed. Nothing's in charge. You cut it in half, there's two, right? You start to see this resilience starting to show up. And I just spent a lot of time studying mycology and overlaying it to Bitcoin, trying to explain everything. So it's like 10,000 words now. It's a long read, but you kind of get every bit of Bitcoin from my perspective through this lens. And it does appear that Bitcoin is some sort of a new digital life form. Lives and breathes on the internet. It consumes electricity. It produces blocks, right? There's all these fun parallels here. And I don't think we have time to go into the meat of it, but that's where it's going. And just Google mycelium of money. There's presentations, there's essays, there's all different types of content about it now.
Yeah, it really is an interesting take. I love it. So let's do these last three kind of rapid fire. So first of all, you've talked about psychedelics. What can you give me, like 30, 60 seconds? I've never done psychedelics. Why don't you sell me on why I should consider it? What's the benefit?
Yeah, I think they're among the most powerful catalysts humans have for perturbing our consciousness. Why might you want to perturb your consciousness? I think of it as like a mental reset in a way. Let's say you're sledding as a kid in the backyard and you have fresh snow. Okay, you take out your sled. Your first run down, you're just on virgin snow. Your second run down, you're on the same path and you get these well-worn grooves in the snow over time. And the sled wants to stay in that little groove, right? Our thought patterns are very similar. We kind of get stuck in these loops and it creates addiction. It creates patterns. It creates unconscious behavior. Taking a psychedelic essentially wipes all those grooves in your brain or in the snow out. Your default mode network, your patterns, wipes it out. And on the back end of that experience, you have a renewed opportunity to make changes in your life. Mm. And so they're not for everyone. These should be treated with respect. But if you want to make a change in your life, you want to learn about yourself, these are powerful tools to do that. They should be, again, treated with the utmost respect, but you can have incredible results, especially if you're in a situation where other less powerful techniques are not getting the job done. This is an effective tool.
Okay.
And so personal development, trauma, it can be mundane things. It can just be fun with your friends. Like, hey, I learned to not take myself so seriously and, you know, laugh at my quirks. And now I see my shadow side a little bit better and I can use that awareness to then make my life better. So it's the experience, yes, can be powerful. You can see and learn things, but the real work is then integrating that into your life going forward. Otherwise, you're just getting high and having a wild experience. But if you don't integrate that into your life, yeah, just hedonism.
Okay. How much creatine are you taking a day right now and why?
So I was on 5 grams a day for, I don't know, off and on since high school. Then I started reading about studies where it crosses the blood-brain barrier at higher doses. So I was taking it for recovery and weight training, stuff like that. Learned about the blood-brain barrier stuff. I started experimenting with 10, 15, 20 grams. And I noticed a cognitive boost in my day-to-day life, especially after poor sleep. And so you have a young kid, you get shit sleep, you got to go to work the next day. Well, double or triple your creatine dose and you might just take the edge off and perform better. And so I'm between 10 and 15 grams a day. I just put it in my smoothie. I joke around on Twitter like 100 grams or 200 grams, but that's just for fun.
And that's all supplemental. So like if you're eating red meat or something, you're getting more of it naturally through your diet. But
Correct. Yeah, the concentration's high in red meat, but you can't get anywhere near 20 grams eating
beef. Yeah. You'd have to eat like 4 or 5 pounds, I think.
At least, something like that.
Yeah, I've always taken on and off 5 grams. I'm a pretty big guy, so I upped it to 10, but now I've experimented with 15 or 20. I'll tell you, I haven't noticed necessarily a benefit. Maybe I need to like stop taking it for a little bit and then kind of get back on. I'm not sure, but I know that the benefits are there whether I'm feeling them or not. In many cases, I think there's like immunity, like a lot of things beyond just sort of the things that you feel.
That's right.
All righty, last question for you. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it?
So I'm going to go back to what I mentioned earlier, which is that I think the ideal target at maturity is 5% self-custody by individual. I think the self-custody maximalist, I mean, my Bitcoin's in self-custody. I think this is the right approach, but most people won't. And I think that it's okay. And so we should work on empowering people to take self-custody. We should try to reduce honeypot risk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we should not shame our parents or some noob for buying the ETF. We should accept human psychology is real and we have patterns and it's predictable, and also do our best when people are ready to help them go into self-custody. And yeah. I also don't think it's a problem if we're at that level of self-custody.
Yeah, I think the important thing is just to emphasize we're at a stage where most of the people who have adopted Bitcoin up to this point can and probably should be in self-custody. like they have the technical ability, they have the curiosity, they have like they meet all the criteria to take self-custody. It's a matter of pushing them over the edge. I think a lot is yet to be determined about what are the options for people, you know, as we go through a fourth tourney and then there's more demand, it's harder for people to get, you know, to have own a UTXO, for example. Like, where do we go from here? In the meantime, at the Bitcoin Way, like our emphasis is get into self-custody because you have that optionality today. Like, you know, let's get to that 5%. We'd love for it to be more than 5%, but I suspect you're right on some level. It's going to be a finite number of people who really do have that. I think the more people we can get there, though, the better. So
yeah,
I think that's a good unpopular opinion.
Tax from the state, the more examples of why self-custody matters, the more, you know, whatever different catalysts in the world that lead people to self-custody. Anytime that happens, we see a big boost, right? Yeah. Go ask Rodolfo, if some exchange gets hacked, he sells cold cars like crazy for the next couple months, right? And so I expect more catalysts to bring people over, and work you guys do and others is very important. I don't want to make it sound like I don't think it's important. I think it's really important, and every individual should want to do that. I'm just coming from a place of, at a certain point, the marginal user will not want to.
Yeah, I think that's probably a reasonable position to take. In the meantime, let's get as many people on in self-custody as we can. So, Brandon, hey, this has been a pleasure, man. I wish we could go for another hour. I would have dug into a lot of these topics deeper, but a lot of fun. Really appreciate your time. Why don't you give a send-off, tell people where they can find you.
Yeah, absolutely. Twitter's home base, or X, bquidum is the handle. DMs are open. Come say hello. I've been at Swan for 5.5 years. Really proud of what we built. If you want to get started buying Bitcoin, either through like a normal brokerage type account or through through a retirement account, a Roth, traditional IRA, et cetera. And we also have a collaborative custody product, Swan Vault. So come get your Bitcoin with Swan. If you have any questions, send me a DM. All my essays are at brandonquidum.com.
Perfect. Brandon, appreciate your time, man. Look forward to catching up again soon.
Thanks, man. Have a good one.
Take care. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation. Loved having Brandon on. Go check him out on Twitter. And of course, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We would love to help you be one of the 5% who are in full self-custody, running a node, doing it right. This is so important. We help with self-custody. We help with online cybersecurity, personal privacy phones that will help you set up. We also have a Plan B residency option. Again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. If you're enjoying the show, do me a favor. Give us a like, subscribe, comment, share it with someone who you think might be interested in it. We'd really, really appreciate that. It helps feed the algorithm, of course. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're at @thebitcoinway_. You can follow me there as well, @theothermjordan. And until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.